Welcome everyone to the Delta Flyers, yet another episode of the Delta Flyers with Robbie and myself. And this week, our special guest is none other than Armin Shimerman. Welcome, Armin.
Welcome,
well,
Armin.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
This is very exciting because, as a lot of you know, Armin's going to be joining us. We're still in the SAG-AFTRA strike. In the future, what's exciting is Armin is going to be joining us for part two of our episode rewatch, and we're going to be talking about
a three-year mission
mission, yes, with the show that Armin was on.
I'm excited.
I'm super excited. Yes, we've had Terry on right before, you know, we were able to talk to her a little bit in one of our Delta Flyer episodes, and now we have Armin, and I'm so excited to have Armin because in a way Armin was really my entree into the franchise
that we were all part of.
He was the very first actor that I met,
and you were so scared in that episode, not only in the first scene
that I shot, but the first person that I met when I came out of wardrobe. They brought me onto your stage and I met you. You were the first actor. Yes. And then that's when you said, hey kid, come on back and let me show you the ropes. And that's when we went to your trailer and you told me about check your force calls, check this, check that, accounting is hired.
That's when I was a union official as
But again, how personable you were to me, how kind you were to me. And then shooting that first scene when I was scared, I was literally about to poop in my pants. I was that scared. And you were just like a calm, you were like a heavy blanket that was thrown across me where I felt like, oh, okay, I can do this. So I think I'm more excited than anyone to have you as part of our team. So thank you so much, Garrett.
That's very sweet. Thank you.
Welcome. Okay.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah.
All right. But for this episode, we want to dive into, you know, your formative years. And from what I can see off of Wikipedia, and you can correct any of this if it's wrong, that you were born in Lakewood, New Jersey. This is what it says.
That's correct. That's
and correct. Neither of your parents were in the industry. Your mother was an accountant. Your father was a painter, house painter. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then at the age of 15, you guys moved from Jersey to Los Angeles. And this is where the question begins. What predicated that move? Why did that happen?
It was an incredible feat that my mother performed. My parents divorced when I was 7 years old. And so my mom became a single parent, bringing up two boys, myself and my brother. She had the help of her mother, who moved from Cleveland to New Jersey, to Lakewood, in order to help bring up her grandchildren. But I was, as you said, 15, and it was getting time to think about college. And my mother was really poor, and she looked around the colleges on the East Coast, and they were just too expensive for her. She did a little bit more research, and she found out that the UC system, the University of California system, was incredibly cheap, almost free. But in order to get that free entrance into the UC system, you had to be a resident of California. You had to be a resident for 2 years. So my mother bravely and boldly packed up her two boys, her mother, everything she had, I don't know how she did it, into a VW bug.
Oh my gosh.
And drove herself and us across country from New Jersey to Santa Monica, California, and moved to California so that her eldest son could go to college. And eventually I did go to UCLA.
It's amazing. But when he talks about that move, that sounds like the plot to the beginning of the story with Ralph Macchio in it, where Ralph Macchio, the single mother, drives across from Jersey to California, where he learns martial arts, right? He learns karate.
Right. I didn't learn martial arts.
No, you didn't learn martial arts when you came over. But still, for her to make that move, that is huge.
It was huge. I look back on that and enormously grateful. She changed my life. It was an enormous sacrifice. As a poor working mother, she had three jobs. She gave up three jobs. She gave up all of her friends. She gave up what was
wow.
Familiar to her.
Yeah.
And did this for the sake of putting her son into college. And at the time, I didn't know that that really was the reason. I came to find that out later on.
That is so moving.
But it was absolutely the best thing to do.
It shows that you and your brother were paramount in your mother's mind in terms of that chess game that we call life. And she literally saw five moves ahead. She's like, okay, if I get him over here, residency will be established, and boom, we'll be able to get that amazing, low cost tuition.
Yeah, I think at that time, UCLA cost per quarter $60 a quarter.
We share the same alma mater. And when I was at UCLA, I was a 16-year-old freshman, and I was paying out-of-state tuition because I wasn't from California.
Right.
And per quarter, it had raised more than $60 by the time I was a freshman in 85. It was then $400 a quarter. So 400, and there's three quarters. That's $1,200 for your entire year, right? Still very low for your tuition. But because I was out of state, it was four times more. So it was $1,700. And so what I did was I petitioned you had to be there for 2 years. And so I asked for, after 2 years, I came in and I said, hey, I've been here 2 years. I want in-state tuition now. And they said, well, because you're still a minor, it goes to your parents' location. And so I still had to pay the exorbitant amount four times more. So what my solution was, I'm only going to go part-time. So I ended up going half of the time and paying less than the $1,700. But I was, duped. I mean, I was such a young kid as a freshman that I was duped by that system of you are still a minor. So you are, even though you've been here for 2 years, your parents are still in Tennessee. So you have to pay that. But it's cool that we both went to the same school, though.
It is. We may have had the same teachers. What was your major, Gary, if I may ask?
My major, yes, it was pre-med when I got there. And then I switched to poli-sci, then I switched to econ, then I switched to history, then I switched again to East Asian studies. But I did all my upper division electives in theater, though. So I was there. And you were in the theater department the entire time?
No, sir. I was an English major who went over to the theater department on a regular basis and auditioned for their plays and magically got cast. By the time you became a student there,
yeah,
they didn't allow non-theater majors to audition for plays. I think I was the last. I think I broke the system. So because he kept giving me lead parts and I wasn't a theater major, I think that pissed off a lot of theater majors.
Oh, yeah. No, they're not happy about that. Who was there when you were there? I'm trying to think.
Most important is a man named David Rhodes, who was my Shakespeare teacher at UCLA. He is the original inspiration, and ironically, he is also responsible for Patrick Stewart being Picard.
What? Tell that story.
Just go into that.
Okay. So David Rhodes is from Texas. I don't know for sure, but I think there may have been some oil money in his family because he always lived rather well.
Hmm.
And one of the things he did at UCLA as an English professor was to bring in actors from England to help with the teaching of Shakespeare at UCLA. And he would bring in, every year, he would bring in some English actors, and I'm not sure what they did. I guess they did some sort of performance in a classroom. But Bob Justman, who was Roddenberry's co-producer, came to one of these classes, for what reason, I don't know, and saw Patrick Stewart performing in David's classroom and went back to Roddenberry and said, I think I found the captain.
Oh my gosh.
Wow.
So we have to thank David Rhodes for that.
That's incredible.
For the first 6 months, he lived in the shell of David's house that he was building in Bel Air. He lived in the construction area. He, his wife, his kids, they all lived in that construction area for the first 6 months until they found a place to live. That wouldn't happen anymore.
No, that wouldn't. Wow, I had no idea. What a stroke of luck and timing, and also a testament to David Rhodes' taste and the kinds of actors that he brought in to inspire the students there. That's incredible.
Yeah, I mean, I wish I had seen it, because he had not only Patrick, he had Ian McKellen, he had Judi Dench. They were all youngsters. They were all what we were when we were doing that franchise. And they were just starting their careers. And so they were very happy to be paid to come over to California and think about their careers there while they were doing work for David Rose.
So wow. The theater department paid to fly these people?
Not the theater, but he's an English teacher. He was an English major.
So the English department paid to have these actors flown over?
I don't know whether they paid or
David did, because he came from money. That would make sense too, you know? If you have all this disposable income that at your disposal, you were a teacher, why not bring in the best, right? So, wow, what a great story.
Let me go back to you. Your mother made this incredible sacrifice. I'm still touched and so moved by that story of what your mother, her thinking ahead as much as she did. And as you said, sacrificing her friendships, her everything familiar, incredible symbol of her love.
It was an enormous act of self-sacrifice.
Yeah.
Enormous. It's so moving. And I never heard this story.
Robbie.
I
was going to say, do you see in the Wikipedia, it says it was his mother who enrolled him in a drama group in an effort to expand his social circle.
That's what I was getting at. What happened?
Yes.
So my first year in Santa Monica High School was rather lonely. I was a new person there, and we know what that's like when you're the outsider. And my mother had a distant cousin who was a drama teacher in Los Angeles. He didn't work at a school per se, but he worked at an organization. And she suggested that I join this acting group. It was just a class, really, that occasionally did productions. And she thought I would make friends there. She got me involved in that, and that's where I sort of got bitten by the bug. And then in addition to that, in my senior year, my English teacher, not David Rhodes, but my high school English teacher, a man named Mr. Jensen, he asked me to audition for The Crucible. And I had never read The Crucible. And I said, sure, I've done a little bit of that in my distant cousin's class. Mm-hmm. And when the casting went up, I saw that I was cast as the role of John Proctor. And I hadn't read the play, so I didn't really know who John Proctor was. I found out that he was the lead in the play. And then I went on from there.
I have a couple of comments I just want to share. First of all, my youngest, graduated from Santa Monica High. So you're both alumni together of a fabulous high school, by the way. It's an incredible high school in Santa Monica.
May I interject? Was it called Sanmo back then as well when you were there?
It was called Sanmo.
All right.
Yes.
It's still Sanmo. Okay.
Sanmo. Yeah. The other thing I want to share is, you know, I got into theater because of a move. We moved from Washington, D.C. to Atlanta, Georgia, and I didn't know anybody. Just like you, it was very lonely. I didn't have any friends. And my mother suggested that this little dance studio where she had signed my little sister up for like ballet for four-year-olds, this little dance studio had a children's theater that needed munchkins for The Wizard of Oz. And she said, they need 100 munchkins, and you should go do this theater thing because you'll meet all these kids. It was the same goal. Just like, go do this theater. Not because my mother cared about theater or, you know, had any agenda.
She didn't want you to be lonely. She wanted you to have friends. Yeah.
And that was the beginning. It did exactly what she planned. Through my junior high school and high school years, that was my family. Those kids in the youth theater, the children's theater, are still some of my closest friends to this day.
And did both your parents, did they regret having that way? Because my mother certainly did.
Oh, she did?
Yeah.
No.
At the beginning of my career, she was very worried that this was going to be a fruitless sort of occupation for me. And it was years after I graduated from college that I was lucky enough to do a Broadway show. And she came to the Broadway show. She said, well, maybe you could make a living.
Maybe this is going to work out.
Maybe you could.
But Armin, that hesitation from your parent, your mother, it's interesting, because I do find that when it comes to Chinese families and Jewish families, there's a lot of similarity. And they're both looking at the arts as not the way to go. Like, you exactly. either go into medicine or law or business. That's it. Those are your choices.
All they want you to do is to be financially secure.
That's
the
it. That's
not financially secure.
Exactly. So we have and that parallel. And I love the fact that you have the parallel with Robbie, that both of your mothers were integral in having both absolutely. Of you be bitten by the acting bug. Without your mothers doing that, neither yeah. of you would be doing this.
That's am absolutely I right? not. And for the same reason, not really because of,
yeah.
not to get me friends. Into the arts. No, it was just to meet kids.
To meet other kids. Yeah.
Exactly. The other thing I'll say, Garrett, off of that, yeah. I'm not from an Asian family or a Jewish family.
Right.
So the thing that my family was concerned about me going into acting was the morals of acting.
Oh,
it was
seriously.
The yeah. Because I came from a very
religious
household.
Yeah.
And it was the morality of the theater
oh
that they
God.
Questioned. That's what it wasn't money.
Right.
It wasn't money. It
the
was
debauchery
that
all the theater debauchery. Actors get, yes, get into, yes. right?
There's a mythology, a false mythology that people have about the arts and theater especially, that a lot of parents buy into because they don't know. They haven't been educated otherwise. It takes, in our cases, children to educate them about what's the reality of being in the theater.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Nothing against my mom, and certainly it's not pejorative. Perhaps it is, but I don't think it is. My mother at one point asked me, so you're in the theater, you must be gay. You must be gay. That's part of the mythology.
Yes, my mother had the same thought. She asked the same question.
Yeah.
yeah.
You're serious, Robbie? Your
yeah.
mom asked you that?
Yes.
Oh my.
Even though I had, gosh. You know, girlfriends and, you know, but it you're in the theater and all those theater boys must be gay. They're all gay, right? You're surrounded
wow.
by, you must, are they trying to convert you or are they, yeah.
Yeah. So that's part of the false mythology. And, you know, it's yes. part of the mythology that all actors are, you know, enormously rich and
yes.
you know, they live the life of Riley and, it's a mythology that people buy into that isn't true.
When I was in college, Armin, I joined a predominantly Jewish fraternity. So I got a call from my mom one day and she was like, you know, she's like, please just promise me two things. I go, what? She goes, don't convert to Judaism and don't turn gay. Those are the two things that she had to throw out there. I'm like,
yeah.
what? I said, Mom, if I want to be a gay Jewish Chinese person, I will be. And so I was very adamant about it.
And you hung up.
I hung up, yeah.
All right. I have a question. Getting back to, so you get to college, you're an English major.
Mm.
And I know about you, Armin, your love for Shakespeare, your passion for that in particular.
Yeah.
How did that connect for you? Where did that come from? And talk about that a bit.
Sure. It's sort of nebulous. I mean, that's a question that I get asked on occasion, and I should have a better answer for it. First of all, David Rhodes was a phenomenal teacher. He inspired me about the language, the ideas, the characters in these plays. And I just became infatuated and I wanted to learn more and more. At UCLA, I was lucky enough to do two or three Shakespearean productions, which further influenced my desire to learn more. And then there was a little tiny, lovely hiccup. While doing one of those plays, All's Well That Ends Well, I was playing a character named Lavash. In doing a little research, I tried to find out who was the first actor who ever played Lavash. And it turned out the actor's name in Shakespeare's company was a man named Robert Armin. His last name was spelled exactly the way my first name is spelled.
Whoa. Oh my God.
And I'm not mystical, not in any way, but I thought that was a sign of something.
Yes.
That perhaps I should, because I was already interested in acting, I was interested in Shakespeare. Perhaps this is a sign that I should follow that path and become another Robert Armin. And in fact, years later, one of my agents suggested I change my name because Shimmerman was so bizarre. And I thought for all of, you know, a month and a half that maybe it should be Armin Roberts, just to acknowledge that connection. But that said, I continue my studies and just prior to graduation, another David Rhodes story, who was enormously influential in my life. It was my senior year. It was the final exams. I had a final exam in David's class, which turned out to be at exactly the same time that I had an audition for the Old Globe Theater in San Diego, which is a Shakespeare festival. And it was the exact same time. And I was convoluted. I really wanted to audition for that theater, but I had my test on the same time, same day. And I went to David Rhodes and asked him, is there any way that I can skip the test, take it on another day, another hour, whatever, which is convenient for you, David, so that I can do the audition? And I remember his words very clearly. He said to me, yes. He said, I've seen you perform in Shakespearean plays, and I think that's something that may be in your future. So we will arrange it so that you can take the test on another day.
Wow.
I went and auditioned for the Globe. I believe there were 800 applicants for eight apprentice roles. And I was fortunate enough to be one of the eight. So, and I got that job. And then, so again, this reinforcement that Shakespeare was my way into the industry, that I had some sort of ability to be a little bit better than my competition in order to get these roles, just made me more interested in performing in Shakespeare. And then after that, after the need to find work was satisfied, I just became more and more interested in not just Shakespeare, but the Elizabethan period per se. And I had studied the two together. And in fact, when I teach Shakespeare, and I have taught Shakespeare for many years, including a stint as the adjunct professor at the University of Southern California, I always integrate not just the performance, but the background, the ethos, the religion, the culture of that period, so that you can better understand what's happening in the plays.
A Bruin teaching a Trojan Shakespeare course.
Okay. My last David Rhodes story. When I got the job at USC, I called David up and I said, will it be okay for me to do this? And for just the reason you said, Garrett. And I was a Bruin teaching Trojans.
Yeah, the rivalry is real, ladies
yes,
and gentlemen.
Yes, it is.
It really is a huge rivalry.
Armin, you know, we just talked to Jeffrey Combs recently, and he also spent a summer at the Old Globe as an apprentice actor. And that was a pivotal moment in his career as well. So,
yeah, Jeff and I have talked about that often. He had an incredibly good time working at the Globe. The Globe was a very fertile ground for nourishing actors that you all recognize. And I was very grateful for the people I worked with. I sat in the corner and watched them perform and tried to glean as much as I could about how they did the things they did. I worked with a director named Jack O'Brien, one of America's finest directors, and it was great to watch him work. It was lovely. And during that summer, the actors there convinced me to move to New York. I thought that I would have a career at the Globe. There was every inclination. Jeff went on to do several seasons, and I thought that would happen to me as well.
Right.
But unfortunately, or fortunately, and this is one of the lovely conundrums of life, sometimes the worst thing that happens in your life is the best thing that happens to you in your life.
Mm-hmm.
If I may take a moment to tell a little bit of a long story.
Yeah.
Towards the end of the season, while I was an apprentice, the actor I was understudying for the plays got a TV pilot and had to leave. And the artistic director, Craig Knoll, told me that I was going to take that actor's place, and I was going to move up in the company from apprentice to an equity position.
Wow.
I was elated by this. I'm 22 years old. Yeah. I'm beside myself happy. In the last performance of Merry Wives of Windsor, I had a costume in Merry Wives that was held by a string. I finished my first scene as Bardolph in that play, and went up to my dressing room, which was way in the back, and just did a Hulk thing, just burst the costume, because I thought I'd never have to wear this piece of shit again. And I like Rumpelstiltskin, I jumped up and down on the costume, smashing it to the ground. And while I'm doing that, I hear on the loudspeaker that there are two actors on stage doing a scene that I'm supposed to be in that costume.
Oh no.
How I had forgotten that, to this day, I don't know how I could have forgotten that, but I did. Costumes in tatters on the floor.
Oh my God.
I'm supposed to be on stage with the two actors. I can hear them ad-libbing Shakespeare.
Ad-libbing Shakespeare.
But the third actor that's supposed to be there, my apprentice role, was not there. I slipped into something, ran downstairs, but by that time the scene was over. They glared at me when they came off stage.
Oh, wow.
The artistic director called me into his office that afternoon and ripped me a new asshole and told me if I didn't need you to replace the actor that I was replacing, that he would fire me on the spot.
Wow.
So I knew my future at the Globe was not going to be
what not good. Yeah.
Not good. And as I said before, the actors had been telling me all summer, the New York actors were telling me all summer, I should move to New York. And when I realized there was no future for me in San Diego, I thought, well, maybe I should move to New York. And I did. And of course, so much good stuff happened to me because I moved to New York. So the worst thing that possibly happened, I screwed myself at the Globe, but because I did, I did absolutely the right choice to move to New York, where my theater career exploded. And I was an enormously fortunate young man at that time. I did a number of Broadway shows, and I shouldn't have. I'm not a singer. I'm not a dancer. I did two Broadway musicals. I don't understand why they cast me, but they did. So,
what are the Broadway shows that you did, Armin? I knew that you had been in New York and worked on Broadway, but I don't know the shows that you were in. What were you in?
Well, the first Broadway show, you don't really, especially the parts I was playing, you don't really need to sing or dance. It's a very famous production of Three Penny Opera with Raul Julia.
Oh, of course, at Lincoln Center.
That's right, at Lincoln Center.
Oh, yeah.
And that ran for a year and a half. As I used to say, I was trapped in a hit. I played sort of a hunchback. And to this day, when I hear Bobby Darin sing Mack the Knife, I can feel my shoulder sort of.
Your physicality changes.
Yeah. That's incredible. That was when the public theater was running Lincoln Center for a brief period.
Precisely.
That was an exciting time and an incredible production. Yeah.
It was an incredible production with a iconoclastic director, Richard Foreman, who was not interested in actors with credits, but was interested in actors with interesting faces, I having one. And he cast me and as I said, we ran for a year and a half in two different venues, one first at Lincoln Center and then in the Park, and met some of my closest friends in that production.
Were you at the Beaumont upstairs? You were in the big theater, right?
Upstairs.
So you and I performed in the same theater. I did 6 Degrees of Separation on that stage.
Oh, yeah. Lovely theater. And my dressing room was the last one on the corridor. If you remember the corridor with all the dressing rooms.
Yes.
As you came into the dressing room area, mine was the first one after the door. Immediately after Three Penny, I auditioned for The Circle in the Square, which was then a Broadway contract, and did St. Joan with Lynn Redgrave. And in both productions was a wonderful, wonderful actor who is my role model, who's passed away now, but was always an inspiration. And that man was Phil Bosco.
Oh, yeah.
And Phil Bosco took me under his wing and gave me lots and lots of wonderful advice. And because I did two shows with him, he played Mack the Knife after Raul left.
Phil Bosco, just another connection there. His agent was a man named Alan Willig. Was Alan your agent by any chance?
No.
He was my agent in New York for a while, and I met Phil Bosco quite a number of times. I never got the good fortune to work with him, but an incredible actor, Phil Bosco.
Incredible actor. And in Shaw, which is with St. Joan, is a Shavian play, no one did Shaw better than Phil Bosco.
Agreed.
Phil Bosco understood Shaw better than anyone. And I used to stand in the wings. There was a particular scene in St. Joan with Phil and two other actors, and it was like watching an orchestra play perfectly. These three actors were so in tune with each other. The language was so gloriously evoked and understood and communicated. And I used to stand in the VOM and watch these three guys work in awe. I've had the good fortune to work with a lot of good people. But that production of St. Joan with Lynn Redgrave and Phil and a ton of wonderful character actors was perhaps the best theater production I ever did and will ever do. It was just flawless. And Lynn Redgrave was super.
What year was that, the St. Joan?
1977.
Okay.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah. And then immediately after that, I got cast in a show called Broadway, which is a George Abbott show, which mm-hmm. didn't do very well. We closed in Boston that didn't happen. And then a couple months went by and I had an audition for Richard Rodgers' last musical called I Remember Mama.
Oh.
As I said, I don't sing or dance. And I had the audition, and I knew I didn't sing or dance. And I thought long and hard about not going to the audition. I thought, what's the point? Why am I wasting my time? They'll never cast me. Ever. And so about an hour before the audition was supposed to happen, I was about to call my agent and say, I'm not going. I got a phone call from Santa Monica, from a friend of mine. And my acting teacher that I had while I was in college, she called to say that the acting teacher had just passed away.
Oh, wow.
Her name was Adrienne Martin, the teacher's name. And when I hung up, I thought, again, I'm not mystical, but I thought, this is a sign. I think Adrienne probably wants me to go do this audition.
Huh.
So I went, I read, they didn't ask me to sing or dance the first audition. They did it the second. Derek, you mentioning how you felt when you were doing that first episode, exponentially worse.
Oh, wow.
Singing and dancing for Richard Rodgers.
When you're I feel for you now.
I do. Then I couldn't believe it. They called me back for a third one. I went in and I had me read. And then they said, can you do your song? And I started to sing, and I was very nervous. And the director, a man named Martin Charman, who's very famous for Annie, he wrote the lyrics and directed Annie. He got up out of the audience, out of the orchestra, and got on stage where I was, put his hand on my shoulder, and said, Armin, just calm down. It'll be fine. We're looking for someone to play this part. You may or may not be the answer. So just calm down. Just calm down.
Oh, yeah.
And lo and behold, they did cast me for that. And I'll end the story with this anecdote, which is one of my favorites. On the first day of rehearsal, everybody was introduced. And after the introductions were made, the director, Martin Charnin, came up to me again, put his hand on my shoulder, and very nicely said, Armin, this character had a song.
Wow.
I thought you were going to say he wanted you to take singing lessons, but no, he took the whole song
they
out.
They just took the song away.
They just took the song. To wrap this story up, the leading man in that show was a man named George Hearn. And George and I became great friends. He had a friend who he introduced me to. Her name was Catherine Swank. And so George introduced me to Kitty, and I've been married happily for 40
years.
Wow. Well, at least 39 happy years anyway.
That was worth it. That's a good ending to the story.
I also think It's amazing what happened at the Old Globe to cause you to move to New York. And it's something, there's a book that I've talked about this on this podcast before. There's a book that I read, and the basic synopsis is that every negative, massively negative thing that happens in your life happens to set you up for something far greater, far better, because the universe, the energy, the universal energy of the universe is always conspiring on your behalf, not going against you. And you proved that. That's a perfect example of what happened, because you missed your cue. You weren't even on stage, and you were, the guy even said, if you weren't here replacing the guy that went to the TV show, I would have fired you on the spot right there. Right. Wow. So, and that extremely, because I know you must have felt like a complete cad after that happened. Like, I can't believe this. I stomped on my costume. It's completely ruined.
I stomped on my big dream. Exactly. Yeah.
And you just ruined your entire, you felt at the time that you ruined your entire career at that point. But what I do want to ask you is, at any point before you got into acting, did you have in your mind another profession that you would have gone into?
Yes. When I went to UCLA, I like yourself, I was a poli-sci major. That's how I started.
Okay.
I thought I was going to be a lawyer. And also, further back, as a young man in a small town in New Jersey, had a lot of religious institutions in it. For the longest time, my family thought, I never thought of that, but my family thought that I would become a rabbi.
Wow.
That never happened. But I think some of that training from my youth is in my personality. I think when I look at myself frankly and see what are my pros and cons, my ability to listen and understand both sides of an argument, I think is rather rabbinical.
Yeah, I would agree.
I like that.
I'm sure that had a big influence on you. Mm-hmm. I wanted to just make another connection, Armin, between your life and mine. I was good friends with Randy Charnin, Martin's son, in New York, and Sasha, his daughter.
Yes,
I knew both of them very well. And I think that one of my first roommates, I shared an apartment with a couple other people, and her name was she was one of the kids in...
Really? In Mama?
In Mama, yeah.
What's her name?
I can't remember. She was, you know, you're young in New York. Well,
can you run through some names?
Alyssa Wolf?
Yes. Alyssa Wolf. Yes.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my God. The first one you pulled up. Alyssa Wolf. We ended up getting an apartment on... Well, it was her family's apartment on 45th between 8th and 9th, right around the corner from... You were at the...
That's right around the corner from where I live, from Manhattan Plaza. I lived in Manhattan.
Okay, so I was in the Whitby with Alyssa Wolf. I can't believe you pulled that name out of the hat.
What a small world.
Alyssa Wolf had an apartment, a two-bedroom apartment, and we, you know, I knew some friends of hers. She was going to NYU at that point. And so she was in Mama, and I remember the marquee was still up. Even the show had closed, but that marquee stayed up for like a year probably.
Yeah, it was a horrible show. No offense to Marty or anybody else. And Marty got fired from the show 3 times. Oh, my God.
Oh, that's funny.
Bette Midler said about Mama, more people came back from Vietnam than came back from I Remember Mama. Because we lost about 30 people were fired from during the course of the
show. Wow.
I remember Alyssa, even though she was a kid in the show, she, you know, the stories of it was a rough experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
Armin, you talk about all the signs that you had, and you're not a mystical person. I am a mystical person. And the fact that you pulled Alyssa Wolf out over any other name, to me, is a sign that this collaboration is the right collaboration.
Good.
That's all.
Good.
Yes. Thanks to Alyssa Wolf.
Podcast
will be,
so successful.
Alyssa Wolf's father was my dentist.
Oh my God!
No, I knew he was a dentist, but
Alyssa, did you go in to see her dentist father?
I did not go to see her father.
That would be crazy.
They were up in Scarsdale, I think, is where her family lived, or something.
Oh my God,
it might be his office was in New York, so maybe
was in the city. Yeah, he may have commuted in. And Alyssa Wolf, my roommate, a few years after we had stopped being roommates, I remember hearing from one of our roommate friends that Alyssa had gotten married or something, and she had opened a pet shop on 9th Avenue, a pet store, pet supplies. So Alyssa was in the pet supplies, and she'd opened that one and then opened a couple more. So in case you're wondering whatever happened to Alyssa Wolf, the kid from your show, your Broadway show, she's a a pet store owner.
There you go.
Or was the last time I heard. Small world.
It's a very small world. These connections that you're telling me about that you have, it makes it an even smaller world. I mean, who knew that we had Marty both as a friend?
Yeah, I didn't know Marty that well, but I knew Randy really well. We used to hang out a lot. We'd go to the gym together, and he was awesome. And then Sasha, the daughter, we were all
When Marty passed away, I wrote a letter to Sasha, and she was very nice about writing me back and said that her father was very proud of my success. And he was very instrumental, obviously.
I can't believe I've known you for 25, 30 years and we've never made that connection. That's what I love about this podcast. These kind of extended conversations that wander into places that we've never even touched on.
I'm also glad you did not change your name from Shimmerman. You did not buckle to the whoever that was that said, that's the weirdest name. If you think of it, I don't know any other person of Jewish background with that name. That's like a unique unicorn last name. It's not Cohen. It's not Goldberg. It's not, you know, Silverstein. It's
not Zimmerman either. You know, many times people think it's going to be Zimmerman and it's not.
It's not Zimmerman. It's separate. It's Shimaman. And I wonder what Shima means in German.
I don't know what it is in German. My father was Polish. He was born in Poland, although now it's Ukraine. It's a little of both. But he once told me that shimmer means to paint. I may be wrong, but this is what he told me.
Oh. And so
he became a painter. He was a house painter. Oh. So he was a shimmer man.
So did he speak Polish to you as a child when you
I don't. I guess, again, my parents were divorced at seven. I was divorced from my father up until the time I was 22 or 23 when I was forced, in a good way, to live with him. When I moved east, I left the globe and went east.
You stayed with your dad then.
I stayed with my dad.
Ah, and that was eye-opening because you hadn't spent any time with him for God knows how long, right?
And I learned a great deal about his past. He was an immigrant who walked from the Ukraine to Greece and took the boat from... Because he wanted to be a Zionist, and he was what? He was about 16, 17 years old. He took a boat to Palestine. It wasn't Israel then. He took a boat to Palestine. And this is where I think my luck gene comes from my dad. It is, there was a boatload of people. The British wouldn't let any of the people on the boat on. But somebody from the Union got on board and said, I need two guys to do painting work in Palestine. And he said, I'll take you, and I'll take you. And one of them was my dad. And so my dad moved to Palestine, where he had a good life. In the meantime, all of his relatives, I had six or eight uncles and a couple of aunts and a grandfather, all of them were wiped out in the Holocaust. So. Oh my God.
But the fact that they picked two random people, and right when you told us that, a bunch of balloons came across your screen. I don't know why that happened. Robbie, was that?
It was not me.
From the mystical standpoint, that was a sign. It was like, where did the balloons come from? I don't even know how we could put balloons on the thing. That's bizarre.
One last creative question before we sign out of here.
Yes.
How would you describe, Armin, your creative process when you're preparing to do a play or any role? Like, where do you start? You've gotten your agent called, you got the job, we're sending you a script, the whole script. Finally, it's not just sides, it's the whole script. What do you start?
That's a great question. And I would venture to say that there are different approaches for different plays. If it's a language play, if it's a Shavian play or a Shakespearean play or a period piece, then I look at how the language is constructed. This is out of my rhetorical studies to see that. That aside, that's the easy part.
To unpack that even a little bit more. So you look at how the language is constructed. How does that inform your creative choices or direction?
Sure. It's a great question, Robbie. What I mean by that is if it's a good playwright, good playwrights know that different characters from different backgrounds speak differently.
Mm-hmm.
Speak differently. It's a different voice for each of those characters, and they construct sentences in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a difference between the clowns in Shakespeare, the way they speak, and Hamlet. They're two different hierarchical members of society. So how does the way they speak tell me, give clues about who they are and what
where they come from, the culture of, that language has been constructed to represent a class or a certain archetype in a way, or maybe, or...
Precisely right. Yeah, so that's why in a classical play, that's the first thing I look at is, what is the language telling me about this character? Once that's informed me, then I began to think about the intentions of the characters. What are the relationships? What is it that my character wants as an overarching, intention? And then, of course, that's the homework you do before the first day of rehearsal. And then rehearsal comes and you meet the other actors in the play, and their desires, their needs, their reaction to their characters will inform you about what you do. My background, aside from classical theater, is neighborhood playhouse technique. So the mantra there is all life comes from the other actor. And so I see what the other actor is doing, and then I respond to that other life in a way that is real and either helps or hinders my intentions.
Yeah. So the neighborhood playhouse is a Sandy Meisner technique for the You're most right. part, which I know Garrett took some classes there. I had very little training in that, but it's a lot about coming, feeding off of what you're getting,
intense
really
listening
in the moment.
Intense listening, and indeed feeding off what the other actor is giving you. And so, one of the nice things is it takes the onus off of you as far as, oh my God, I have to come up with everything. You don't in neighborhood playhouse technique. You just really have to respond to what the other person is giving you.
You're on autopilot, pretty much. You are not creating anything except for just listening so hard to what's being given to you. That's it, right? So
that's
I love
right.
it. So
it feels very close.
It becomes a partnership as opposed to a solo performance.
Correct. Yeah. Yes.
It feels very close to like comedy improv, like, UCB kind of, Upright Citizens Brigade or Groundlings, the kind of listening and reacting in a comedy improv. Techniques and the tools that they use there. It seems very similar to that.
And because of that, I would always label myself an ensemble player. I've never thought of myself as a solo actor. I am part of an ensemble. And also part of what my approach to a character is, how does my character fit into the entire piece? Mm-hmm. How do I help tell the story? The story's not about me, although I always think I'm the lead, no matter which, I may have three lines in the show, but I am the lead. But how does my character fit into the telling of this story? And that is part of my approach as well.
Do either of you utilize that one technique where you do massive backstory homework, where you create this whole life that's not even in the play or the script?
I wish I did that. I don't. It's something I'm bad at. I don't do that.
Yeah.
I just get my hints from the script and then from the other actors.
Gotcha.
I don't do backstory. Although ironically, the novels that I've written is an enormous amount of words about the backstory for the characters of 12 months.
Okay.
Yeah. It's funny for backstory for me. Mm. I don't think I did that as an actor.
Right.
That was not a habit or a practice.
It wasn't part of your process.
It wasn't big backstory stuff. Yep. But as a director, when I get a script, I will do one of my first things I do. I know we're interviewing you, Armin. This is about your creative process, but it makes me think about.
Well, I asked you, Robbie. So go. Yeah.
I take a script and I start, I'll take a highlighter of a particular color, whatever happens to be handy, and I'll start underlining facts. It has to be a fact, not a character's opinion, not their feelings.
Yeah.
I'll make notes of facts because the facts of that script are what everything, that's the foundation that everything grows from.
Mm-hmm.
And it also knowing the facts helps me with actors when we're in a scene and they're like, I just don't know how to play this. I'm coming in the room and I'm supposed to be angry. And I'll go back to my facts and I'll say, well, I'm supposed to be angry with this other character, for example, making this up. But I'll say, well, we know the fact is the scene before you receive surprise information. We know the fact is you say, you know, you had so much work today. Sorry, you're late. So we know you had a long day at work, stress at work. You've been stewing on this information since yesterday. That's just facts.
Yeah.
So I tend to like try to rely on facts more than backstory can have a lot of bias and a lot of opinion. And I can start to imagine things that have nothing to do with this particular script. Mm-hmm. It's just my fantasy life going off, right? That's why I tend to, in fact, when actors come in and often will say, well, you know, I was thinking the backstory is his mother abandoned him and his father. And I'm like, that's not in our script.
Yeah.
That's not a fact that I know.
It's too subjective, isn't it? It's just,
Like if that's what you're relying on to fuel, you know, qualities of this scene,
right,
that's all made up. What we need to use as fuel is the facts that we know. That's why I think your attraction to Shakespeare and this classical language, Armin, makes so much sense to me, because what I know of it, you know, when Shakespeare wrote his plays, no one had thought about Freudian neuroses or psychiatry or any of that. So characters didn't speak from their subconscious because Shakespeare didn't know that existed, really, not in the way we know it. So when they spoke, it was from a conscious discovering in the moment these thoughts and ideas. They weren't thinking and feeling something and then having their neurotic childhoods interpret it into words. Yeah. They were speaking it because they were, that's what I love about Shakespeare, is that it's, you know, they didn't have the same baggage that we modern, you know, that modern humans have with knowing what we know about how the brain works, how emotions work, how therapy works. They didn't think that way. It was just what you see is what you get.
Right. And unless they were being nefarious, they usually spoke from the heart.
Right.
And oftentimes when I'm dealing with Shakespeare, either as a teacher or as a director, and an actor will say, well, so-and-so, I feel this because of this. And I say, well, where's that in the text? Where is that in the text?
Mm-hmm.
And if they can't give that to you, then you say, then you've just made it up. Let me give you a very clear example, one that might shock you. So we all know the play Hamlet. We all assume that Hamlet is in love with Ophelia. People for centuries have thought that.
Correct.
There's no place in the text that says that.
Right.
He says two things about his relationship with Ophelia.
Yeah.
He said, I did love you once.
Okay.
So that's a possibility. But immediately after that, he said, I loved you not. So which is the true one? Which is the true one?
Yeah.
You can't assume that Hamlet is still in love with Ophelia. He may have loved her once, but he may not be loving her now. As a wonderful teacher once said to me, Hamlet's gone off to college. We all know the experience of somebody in high school going off to college.
Yes.
And when he comes back from college, or when she comes back from college, the relationship between his high school or her high school lover is not the same.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So
great
there's
example.
One. If it's not in the text, then like you're saying, Robbie, let's cut it out. Let's not count on it.
It's a distraction.
It is.
Now, if I'm directing and an actor is using whatever they're using and the story is being told and it's working, I leave it alone. Like if that's how they want to.
Yeah, so you don't
take that's how they want to get there.
Yeah.
But when it is not working, that's when I go back to the text. It's got to be a fact of this script that comes out of this text, not out of our fantasies and our made up, you know, backstory.
You have to play what's there, not what you want it to be. The playwright is the primary creator.
Yes.
Correct.
The playwright or the script writer, the script is what comes first. Sorry to the actor, sorry to everybody else, but the script is what comes first.
Yeah.
And then we can embellish it, we can improve it, we can denigrate it, we can do anything to the script. But the script comes first.
Agreed.
And then, as you're saying, look at the script, see what's there, and either work for the playwright and give him or her what they want, or find a new interpretation and say, well, I'm going to go in a different direction. But be aware you're doing that.
Yes, absolutely.
I do find that I feel that actors who do extensive backstory for their character, and I'm talking about not just paragraphs, but pages upon pages, I find that they feel that they will come off as having more life when they're on stage. And the reality is you will have more life if you're so intensely listening to what the other person's saying. That's enough. You don't have to think about, and then my character was abused when he was six, you know, and then my character did this. And I find it, it's a bit of a waste of time. So, you know, and so anyway, I just want to share the sentiment that I also, as an actor, never did extensive backstory like that. But I was just curious to see if either of you
had agree more. And what you're talking about, I took one or two classes in the method, and that's what they focus on. Mm-hmm. I always thought that was just too egotistical for me. I just, because you only think about me, and not about anybody else.
Yeah.
I was in an acting class once, and I was doing scenes from an Australian play called The Sum of Us. And this character had an Australian accent, and the teacher felt like I was getting too caught up in the technical side of, you know, I was self-conscious of my accent and it wasn't flowing authentically. So she said, I want you to do an exercise, sit in the chair in front of class, tell us a story of your childhood, just off the top of your head, pick a moment and anything, doesn't have to be important, just a story. Uh-huh. So I start telling a story. I'm telling the story about my real childhood as Robbie. I'm telling the story for 3, 4, maybe 5 minutes. And then she stops me and she says, okay, stop. She says, now I want you to jump to the character and tell me a story from his childhood in the accent with everything. And because I had experienced in my body a few minutes of telling a story, getting lost in the story, being as natural and as much Robbie as I could be, and then having to immediately do the same thing with an accent as this character, I was able to sort of physically and internally sort of experience owning this character, owning the accent. So the backstory was all made up. I just made up a story about, it was an exercise. Right. I wouldn't have used that backstory. It was an exercise for the process of kind of making this character, his dialect, his way of speaking, all of that, to making it mine, to owning it. It was just about that process. It wasn't about the story or the backstory or any of those facts, because that had to go back to the play. But that was a great exercise.
Right. It was coming from your heart and not from your brain. You weren't showing the audience how smart you were. You were just simply making it your own.
Just making my own. And that was a great creative practice. It was just practice. But the backstory, whatever words came out of my mouth, had no value to the play, really.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
We've come to the end of our podcast. We just want to say thank you again. And we have really, we've dug up some things that we didn't know anything about regarding you and the parallels that not only Robbie, but myself have with your life and the people that you have interacted with and Robbie has interacted with and I've interacted with. We have a lot of parallels there. So super, super cool. So thank you so much.
And the fickleness of fortune as well, of what sometimes happens that seems ill, but turns out to be something that's great.
A good thing, exactly. All right, well, thanks everyone for tuning in to this episode of the Delta Flyers. For all the Patreon patrons, please stay tuned for your bonus material.